And welcome to the second half of episode 42 in the Steve Chung Show. More with the standings of volleyball. St. Martin's 9th, 4-14. Conference 6-20 overall, and Montana State Billings is last at 0-18 conference, 7-21 overall. In the second half, there will be a feature on the SFU Red Leafs hockey, an interview with the Burnaby East MLA Rohini Arora with the background and latest on the Surrey Police transition after the following messages.
If you're a regular listener of this show or other shows on CJSF, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us about what you like and why you like it, as well as ways we can improve our programming. To leave comments, please email cjsfprog@sfu.ca or call 778-782-4423. This information can also be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
Now I'd like to feature the SFU Red Leafs hockey at this time. The BCIHL Red Leafs visited the Vancouver Island University Mariners at Nanaimo Ice Center on November 23rd. The hosts jumped early in the game as Max Strauss scored his second, 7-18 into the game on a power play, followed by Ethan Jones less than 2 minutes later at 9:06. Cole McGuire gave VIU a three-goal bulge with 6:23 left in the first, with his first of the year, followed by Ethan Jones, second of the game, 3:04 later, with 3:19 left, and went up 5-0 after Blake Powers' first goal with 1:08 left in the first. The SFU starter, Andrew Henderson, who played with the non-conference Red Leafs last season, surrendered 5 goals on 25 Mariners shots in 20 minutes, during when SFU mustered just 3 shots and was replaced by Lachlan Abel for the start of second period. However, the Mariners' offensive assault resumed in the second as David Sato scored his 4th at 10:34, which was answered by the Red Leafs captain Nick Wagner with his 3rd, 1:12 later, at 11:46. But VIU restored their 6-goal cushion late in the second as Ethan Jones scored his 3rd of the night for 10th with 1:08 left, as SFU ended period 2 down 7-1, where the Mariners outshot the Red Leafs 14-9 in the second. VIU went up 8-1 at 1:07 into the third on Owen Wee's 2nd, followed by Jackson Good's 1st with 5:19 left. I think it might have been with 5:19 left in the Let me get the 9th goal. So Jackson Good scored his first, 5:19 left, to put the VIU up 9-1. And capped the scoring on Cage Newman's 5th with 2:14 left in regulation, all on SFU's Lachlan Abel, who yielded 5 goals on 30 shots and was named the 3rd star of the game, where the Red Leafs were outshot by the Mariners 55-17 as Ethan Jones was named the 1st star with a hat-trick, an assist, and Owen Weiss was named the 2nd star with a goal and 4 assists at Nanaimo Ice Center, where the VIU Mariners destroyed the SFU BCIHL Red Leafs 10-1 at Nanaimo Ice Center on November 23rd. 2 days later, Nick Wagner and Jaden Fauchuk were named as BCIHL All-Stars. Here are the current standings in the BCIHL. 2 points awarded for a win, with 1 point for an OT or shootout loss. Vancouver Island University, first, 7-0-1, 15 points, much like University of Victoria, but they're second as they're 7-2-1, 15 points. The Logan Lake Miners, 3rd, 3-4-1, 7 points. Simon Fraser, 4th, 3-6, 6 points. And the Okanagan Lakers are last at 2-5-2, 6 points. Meanwhile, tonight sees the SFU non-conference Red Leafs returning to action as they renew their rivalry against the UVic Vikes of the BCIHL. The puck drop at Burnaby's Bill Copeland, which is also SFU alumni night, is at 7 p.m.
Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.
Sorry, I'm just going to play Ria Arora's interview. Just have to find it now. Sorry about... I just found it. I will play it now. Hello, it's Steve Chong. Today is November 28th, 2024, and on the line is...
MLA Rohini Arora
is the new MLA for Burnaby East, where the SFU Burnaby Main Campus is part of, and is the new deputy chair for the BC NDP government, which won a slim majority last month. Rohini, thank you for the interview today.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, tell me about your background.
Yeah, for sure. So I've been in working tangentially or even within constituency offices and on campaigns for 11 years, going on 12 years. I studied political science and linguistics. So I had always a keen interest in governance, issues that cross many communities, and ways that we can bring more inclusion and justice for people. It's been something that's always driven me. And I worked in government in Alberta under Rachel Notley. I was a stakeholder relations manager with South Asian and German communities. So stakeholder engagement is also something that is super important to me in terms of the way that we go about making decisions. And it's something that I feel this government prioritizes as well, which is equally important to me. And then recently, I was at the BC Federation of Labor as their director of organizing and campaigns up until I was elected as an MLA.
Now to the BC legislature. Explain why the BC legislature will return February 18th next year, 4 months after the last session on October 19th.
Yeah, so I think that more has to do with considering the fact that, you know, people are going to be going on holidays. I mean, December is a time that a lot of folks are on vacation, so that's something to take into consideration. But generally speaking, governments usually do start their legislative calendars in February.
From your page on the BC NDP website, it says the party will make housing affordable with keeping rent control, providing a renters debate, and restore tens of thousands of units via speculation tax. Explain how would the speculation tax restore rental units where vacancy rates in North Burnaby, which includes East Burnaby, is 1%, according to the Canada Mortgage Housing and Corporation website.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is something really important. Standing up to speculators is a key priority within our action plan. And part of that is that experts also say that we will be creating 300,000 additional middle-class homes. So we're tackling housing costs by taking on speculators, cutting red tape, and breaking down barriers to construction. So it's not just one piece, it's sort of part of a bigger whole. And then taking on real estate speculators that are driving up housing costs. And part of that has been the speculation tax has turned well over 20,000 empty condos into long-term homes, homes that are severely needed by people that are living locally and don't want to be pushed out of their city. The other piece is bringing in the new flipping tax so families that are trying to buy a home don't have to compete with house flippers. And the reason that matters is because the increase in prices means a higher mortgage, means a higher rent ultimately. And then restricting short-term rentals, like Airbnbs. That means turning thousands of units into long-term homes.
But how will the BCNDP balance the concerns of many landlords who often complain about the annual maximum residential rental increases, i.e. being too low?
Yeah, so part of that is that we have to take into consideration everyone. And so, of course, landlords are concerned about their piece, but we also have to consider renters. And so the way that we meet that issue is to ensure that they are able to have an increase, that is, and there are special circumstances where they can apply depending on their situation. There have been two instances where they were granted the ability to raise the rent because of certain details that I don't have exact access to. That's something that sits with the residential tenancy board, but there is a pathway if necessary in dire circumstances. But generally speaking, if we're going to serve everyone in Burnaby, where many people are landlords, but there's also many renters, especially around the SFU area, where we have so many folks that are looking for affordable rent, we need to ensure that they're able to afford that rent. And at the same time, landlords and homeowners are still able to raise their rent by a significant enough portion that they're able to cover their expenses. We have to think about every person.
One more question on housing. What is your response to some people who often bought their condos or houses for short-term rentals but have to sell at losses?
Well, we have to look at the market, and technically condo prices have not really gone down. In fact, larger and more expensive single family homes have gone, have had a little bit of a hit in the market, but not condos. So that is not necessarily true. And that depends on which area you're talking about as well.
Now shifting gears. While the ICBC's no-fault insurance policy, which the BCNDP brought in a few years ago, has saved many BC residents money, but have also hurt many who suffer major injuries from car crashes, how will the BCNDP balance the needs to lower insurance costs, but also needs of those who suffer major injuries?
Well, absolutely. Look, people deserve affordable car insurance, and we want a future where British Columbians can get ahead and not just get by. The old system forced people to go to court to get money to pay for their care. They had to wait for years for a settlement, and a lot of that money went to expensive lawyers and legal costs, and that didn't ultimately work for people, and the response was overwhelming. Enhanced care, which is the current system, gets the injured person the care they need for as long as they need it, without costing them any money out of pocket. And that means quite a bit in this moment, because that means that people don't have to pull money out of their pocket that they already don't have to get the care they need, and then have to wait for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, in some cases 8 or 9 years, to get just a portion of that money back.
Now to healthcare. How will the BCNDP address doctor shortages with emergency room closures in rural areas of BC seemingly every week?
Yeah, definitely. Look, there's a pool of healthcare workers in the country, and everyone is trying to get access to them. One of the things that the government has been working hard at is ensuring that they're changing the way that we do international credentialing, which means getting doctors into the system. In the last few years, we have 1,900 doctors in the system now that we didn't have before, including thousands of nurses. We're also looking at opportunities for, getting training on the job. So we've had, I think, 1,700 more care aides that have been trained while on the job and then have access to it. And so, if we could wave a magic wand and have everyone we need in every area of the province, that would be obviously ideal. But the reality is that there's a limited pool, and everyone is trying to get access to them in every province and the territories in this country.
Now to clean energy. The BC NDP government wants to have 90% of new vehicles to be electric by 2030, 100% by 2035. But a survey from Ledger's LEO poll, which interviewed about 1,000 BC residents and was released last month, found about half of the respondents oppose the BC NDP government's EV mandate due to higher prices and lack of charging infrastructure. Please counter.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is something that is a priority, and part of that is ensuring that we have enough charging stations. So that's something that we're investing money in, to ensure that there's places for people where they need it, when they need it. It's hard to imagine this vision without having access to what we need right now. But charging stations don't take years and years to build, right? They take a certain period of time. And when we have more and more of them in every city, and especially in urban centers, then people are going to see that pathway. And I can use an example. In the 2014 municipal election, I remember in Vancouver, bike lanes were something that was a contested issue. And it was interesting because at the time, the vision was that more and more people would be able to, and this goes to clean energy, would be able to take the bike path to work, taking cars off the road, and then it would be something that would be used more and more. And what they found is immediately after, once the bike lane was created, that created the opportunity as an option for people, and many people opted in. And so I kind of see that happening in the same manner. So yes, there's a vision, you know, by 2035. However, there's a plan in place to address the charging station so we can get to a point where people feel comfortable knowing they're going to be able to get to and from wherever they need to, anywhere in the GVRD, because they will have the infrastructure set up to support them.
Now moving to environment, which ties with clean energy. The Trans Mountain expansion has been a huge issue for SFU and in East Burnaby, with a major spill back in 2007. But recently, Burnaby signed an agreement with the Trans Mountain Corporation, where the city will receive around $20.1 million in the next 21 years. How will you, as the MLA for the Burnaby East, represent concerns of the residents from the Trans Mountain expansion?
Well, I am a resident of the Trans Mountain expansion. The oil reservoir is my backyard, and I am from the neighborhood of West Ridge, where oil spills happened in 2007 here. And so for me, it is a major concern for many of my neighbors. And when I was door knocking in this area throughout the election, it was a concern for many of the residents, specifically in my neighborhood, and it came up again and again. That being said, unfortunately, it's a federal, you know, project, and that gives us limited ability. But the province and even the city has fought against it as much as they could, including Allison Gu, who you might know, and same with my predecessor, Katrina Chen. This is a major concern. We are worried about the increase by 7 times of the tanker traffic. You know, there's general noise issues, there's pollution, you know, there's air quality issues, there's the general risk to the ecosystem. So these are things that are of big importance to me personally, and I've been in this neighborhood for about, I'd say about 13 years at this point, or 12, 13 years, and it has been an issue consistently. This is something that matters to me quite a bit, and to my neighbors and to the residents and constituents of Burnaby East. So this is something that wherever I can be of support and help to ensure that there is safety, that the environmental safety is being, protocols are being followed as best as possible. Again, we're limited because it's under federal jurisdiction, but that's not going to stop me from advocating for my neighborhood.
This will be the final question. The Trans Mountain expansion also ties into the U.S. President-elect Donald Trump, who is very pro-fossil fuel production and has threatened to hit 25% tariffs to Canadian-Mexican goods, mainly due to illegal migrants going into the United States. How will the BC NDP government confront Trump's tactics?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, and this is something that our premier has been sharing quite a bit. He recently met, I think it was yesterday, with all the premiers across the country and the prime minister to come up with a Team Canada strategy. Obviously, a 25% tariff harms us economically, and also Mexico and other countries that are relying on, exporting goods to the U.S. So this is something that we are not taking lightly. It's something that we are deeply concerned about because it's going to have an impact on our economy. And it's something to say that we've had throughout COVID, we've had a strong economy, even though many of us have felt, you know, the struggle and have been dealing with difficulties with paying our bills and daily goods. This tariff is an even bigger threat. And I think what it's going to take is all of our folks getting together, which is what's happening, with the premier meeting with the other premiers and the prime minister, to have a strategy to, hopefully be able to communicate and bargain in good faith and come to an agreement with the U.S. and with Trump.
Thank you for the interview this morning. I really appreciate your expertise. This interview will be online sometime this afternoon.
Thanks so much, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was my interview with the Burnaby East MLA, Rohini Arora. Now I'd like to talk about the Surrey Police transition at this time. It had been the most polarizing topic in Surrey for the last 6 years. The then Mayor Doug McCallum pursued a Surrey Police Service, which was approved by the BC government in 2020. Fast forward to 2022, Brenda Locke, who campaigned to stop the Surrey Police Service, became the mayor by beating McCallum with less than 1,000 votes on October 15th, 2022. But Mike Farnworth, BC's Minister of Public Safety and Solicitor General at the time, ordered Surrey City to continue with the Surrey Police Service on July 19, 2023. However, Locke's fight did not end right away, as her two petitions against the BC NDP government for a judicial review on being forced to continue with the SPS was rejected on May 23, 2024, followed by her acceptance of the court's decision on June 10th, and culminated by an agreement between the BC NDP government and Surrey City on July 10th, according to a BC government news release. Surrey will receive $30 million a year to 2029, when a financial guarantee of up to $20 million, if the SPS salaries are higher than the RCMP, may kick in and continue until 2034, for a total of up to $250 million. Surrey will fully support the transition to the SPS and not impose a police tax in the next decade. In addition, according to the BC government news release, the SPB budget, originally requested at $141.5 million, fits within Surrey's financial budget and will hire 526 officers by the end of 2024, 67% of all Surrey police officers. All of this week's developments were from X. On November 24th, Surgeon Dale Quaring participated in the Surrey Food Bank Drive in front of Superstore on 7500 King George Boulevard. As the SPS prepare for their big day all this week, the SPB had their latest meeting on November 27th, where not only SPS numbers until October were reviewed. The Chief, Norm Lipinski, predicted a full transition from the RCMP is not expected for a while, in 2026 or 2027. The SPS will provide frontline policing in Whalley, Newton, while the RCMP will cover our other areas of Surrey, Fleetwood, Cloverdale, Guildford, Port Kells, and South Surrey, the last of which the SPS will take over sometime next year, but specialized units will be provided for both forces, the SPS and BCRCMP Provincial Police Force throughout the city, with the SPS currently having 446 officers, where 270 officers are on the front lines, along with the RCMP. According to Gordon Hoekstra of Vancouver Province Sun and Tom Sitarok of Surrey Now Leader, the SPB meeting on November 27th was also the last for Mike Sir, the SPB administrator, and the former Abbotsford police chief, as a new board is expected next January, according to Sitarok. Today, the Surrey Police Service became Surrey's police jurisdiction. At 12 a.m., as the Surrey RCMP becomes the BC RCMP Surrey Support Unit, as Wendy Mayhot oversees the decommissioning of the Surrey RCMP, according to Indo-Canadian Voice Online. Wendy Mayhot is formerly the Rich Meadows RCMP Superintendent. The detachment that covers Maple Ridge and Pitt Meadows. Today, there was a press conference this afternoon. Surrey Police Service is now the police jurisdiction within Surrey City, where several people attended, including Brenda Locke, who campaigned to stop the Surrey Police Service as well. Let me look. Sorry. This all happened today. Brenda Locke was asked if she supports the Surrey Police Service. She does support the Surrey Police Service with assistance from the province. But according to Ashiana Khan, a journalist, $200 million was squandered in delaying the transition. The press conference happened in the old Surrey RCMP headquarters. This all just happened a few hours ago. A press release has shown that the 911 and non-emergency numbers have remained the same. The non-emergency is 604-599-0502. The BC Provincial Police Service will provide temporary policing supports in Surrey until the SPS is fully established. Right now, there are a much higher concentration of frontline SPS officers in Whalley, which is city center, and Newton, with more officers in Guildford, Cloverdale, Fleetwood, and South Surrey. The SPS has insisted there will be no interruption to ongoing investigations during the transition. The BC RCMP Provincial Police Service, which has effectively supplanted the Surrey RCMP Municipal Police Service, which ended 12 a.m., was thanked by the SPS for the past and current members of the Surrey RCMP, as the detachment served Surrey since 1951. Also, there have been 380 civilian police professionals that joined the SPS this morning, according to the SPS Twitter page. Right now, the Surrey Police Service has 446 officers, with almost as many civilian police professionals, likely from the old Surrey RCMP. Thank you for listening to episode 46 of the Steve Chong Show in 2024, part of Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 FM, the campus community radio station for Simon Fraser University. I'm your host, Steve Chong. Coming up at 4, it is Voice of the North. I'd like to provide an update on the only game going on in the SFU Athletics right now. The men's basketball team is trailing Academy of Arts 35-24 with the game just a minute, please. The Academy of Art is based in California. The game is apparently in San Francisco, California.